Welcome to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. Well, maybe you are like me. When you read the Bible, you have a hard time keeping up with the names of the people. You have a tough time keeping the stories in context. And then all of a sudden, your memory just fails you when you try to remember the names of some of the prophets or the kings and some of the New Testament characters. Well, there's help on the way. National Geographic has a brand new book called National Geographic's Who's Who in the Bible. And the author, editor, assembler, curator of the beautiful book is Jean-Pierre Isbaut, who is our guest. Thank you. Do I call you doctor, mister, professor, director, author? What is the title we should give you?
Just Jean-Pierre will be fine.
Jean-Pierre. All right. Well, if you'll say DG, which is just initials and not some not a real name, I'll call you Jean-Pierre, and if that's okay. Tell us about this book and its history and what you sought to accomplish.
Well, thank you, DG. Well, how it came about is that in 2007, National Geographic asked me to write a book called The Biblical World, which was really trying to put the Bible in the context of its geography and its culture. And we did that book in 2007, and lo and behold, it went out and became a bestseller. And I don't know who was more surprised, my editor, Lisa Thomas, or myself. But it showed us that this type of approach really resonates with people. You know, the idea of taking biblical material and making it come alive with gorgeous maps and pictures and art and so forth. So we followed it up with a second book, which was called In the Footsteps of Jesus, last year. And with that book, I tried to really transport the reader into the world of Lower Galilee of the first century. You know, it's almost like a time capsule. You know, I really want people to read this book and feel like they're walking in the footsteps. They're really moving from village to village, you know, smelling the scent and seeing the sights that Jesus would have seen. And that book became a bestseller in 8 weeks. And at that point, Lisa said, well, what do we do for an encore? So I Washington, and we very quickly came to the conclusion that we needed to do a new Who's Who. There hadn't been a Who's Who illustrated Who's Who for quite some time. And so many new discoveries have been made in the Holy Land that we felt it was time to do a new and fully illustrated, comprehensive guide to the men and women in the Bible.
One of the great things about the book from this reader's and viewer's standpoint is the luscious illustrations. When we read the Bible, we're left without, we're reading cold text and trying to imagine what these people look like. What you've done is collect the imaginations of artists and others over at least two centuries of artist imaginations, I guess, or based on their own feeling of what these people in your Who's Who looked like. So you're overwhelmed with rich and varied descriptions, artistic descriptions of the people whom you write about. It's a little bit of a challenge to try to illustrate when we don't really have, when there were no cameras back then.
No, I don't think so. I've been looking for those Kodak snapshots. I can't find them. You know, but what we try to do is really visualize the story. These stories are so beautiful. They are so incredibly rich. You know, I really wanted to do a book that a family can enjoy. I have two grandsons, 1 and 3 years old, and I wanted to make a book that I could use to introduce my grandkids to the great richness and the magic of the biblical story. And to visualize that, we do three things. On the one hand, I wanted to get the latest location photography, so I went out there, and for about 18 months, several trips during those 18 months, my wife Kathy and I, we traveled through Israel, through Jordan, through the Palestinian Authority, Egypt, really taking the latest photography, the latest pictures of how these lands appear today. The second thing is, together with our wonderful photo editor, Matt Proford of National Geographic, we really looked at the full breadth of art and I'm an art historian as well, in addition to a biblical archaeologist, so I know a little bit about the paintings that have been done, and I'm particularly partial to the late 16th century, the late Baroque Italian artist Caravaggio, because he has this wonderful way of illuminating scenes from the Bible, but the dramatic light, you know, you could almost be in a modern motion picture, and so we use a lot of Caravaggio. And then the 19th century artists, they have a real sense of the archaeological accuracy. You know, this is when a lot of the new excavations are done in the 19th century, a lot of new discoveries. So a lot of artists really allow themselves to be educated about what life in Palestine was like, what life in ancient Egypt was like, and their paintings have a tremendous realism. So we were definitely partial to those periods, but we were careful to also have beautiful illuminated manuscripts from the Gothic period, or paintings by Renaissance artists, so that, and even from Dutch masters. So there is a nice spread of different styles. So the overarching goal was to make sure that the art supports and illustrates the biblical narrative.
I was trying to think of another book that is so richly illustrated at a fairly reasonable price, and I wonder what is work is it, does is National Geographic the publishers, or are they just the experts at being able to accommodate sort of luscious color renderings of photographs or of paintings in a way that it can be done fairly economically?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, of course, I'm partial.
Yeah. Well, that was sort of a fastball right across the plate. I should be asking you hard questions.
But you know, I know a little bit about, not a whole lot, but I know a little bit about, you know, the digital printing, and it's not only very expensive these days to produce something like this, but also very complex, because I'm looking at one page here, page 33. And we have archaeological object, we have paintings, and we have maps. All of these three elements on just one page represent a great challenge for a printer, because each of these have different color palettes. And yet, I want to make sure that these things are represented with a great degree of high resolution and high fidelity. I have not seen any publisher who can do it with this type of quality as National Geographic. And of course, that's their forte. And you know, I worked with a great team. You know, this is not the work of one individual. I had Barbara Payne as my editor, Kay Hankins was our graphic artist who created all of these beautiful layouts. And every week we would get on the phone, Kay would send in her latest layouts. And so we literally went page by page through this entire book just to make sure that it reflected the vision that we had for it from the very beginning.
Well, the other challenge of at least for me, I've studied Bible in college, and I try to keep up in Sunday school and, you know, do my Bible readings regularly. But covering the Bible from a scholar's viewpoint, or even a popular viewpoint, all the way from Adam and Eve, all the way through the crucifixion, resurrection, and then through Paul's journeys, and then, as you've done, an epilogue sort of covering the history of the Christian experience following after Paul's establishment of the churches. This is a scholarly, it's a tangle of scholarship, isn't it? I mean, how do you, you can't be the total scholar of the whole thing. How do you manage to deal with the challenges that have been so tough for the rest of us?
Well, absolutely, you're right. I mean, my expertise is as a biblical archaeologist, so I do approach things from that perspective. But I try to stay abreast of the literature, and you know, we have various organizations in the United States, Society of Biblical Literature, for example, SBL, that publishes one wonderful journal, and so I try to stay up to speed on the latest insights in source criticism, literary criticism, and so forth. But most importantly, I think what is important is that so many exciting things are happening in Israel right now with excavations. Just give you one quick example. In the last year, for example, I was just astonished to be able to visit Magdala. This is the place of Mary Magdalene, Mary of Magdala. Today in modern Hebrew, it's called Migdal. It's a modern place. And we sort of knew where the ancient town was located, but it's been discovered just in the last few years. And last year, excavations began in earnest. It's led by a wonderful Mexican woman, her name is Marcela Zapata Neva, of the Mexican Mexico School University. And she led me around, and to walk in streets where Mary Magdalene walked, you see these beautiful mikvah, these ritual bathing pools, and gorgeous mosaic. It's just wonderful.
Well, we're visiting with the Professor Jean-Pierre Isbot, and we're going to take a quick break. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. We're talking about the Bible, and we're talking about National Geographic, and we're talking about National Geographic's new book, Who's Who in the Bible. We're talking with the author, editor, assembler, Jean-Pierre Isbot. He's also the author of several other best-selling National Geographic books related to the Bible, including In the Footsteps of Jesus. You gave me permission to call you Jean-Pierre, and I'll do that if that's okay.
Absolutely, D.G., absolutely.
You mentioned Mary Magdalene, and one of the challenges that you stood up to is helping us understand who these Marys were in the New Testament, who surrounded Jesus in his life, including his mother, perhaps his mother's sister, this Mary Magdalene, Mary, the mother of James. They're just, where did all these Marys come from, and how were you able to sort them out in terms of establishing your who's who, to teach us who these people were?
Absolutely, yeah. I know that's a great example of the fact that many names in the Bible reappear. You know, it's a Jewish tradition that you name your child after a famous person in Scripture. And so there are many, many Marys, for example, as you say, in the Gospels, and we're not always quite sure who the Mary is, who these Marys are, because, let's face it, Mary or Miriam in Aramaic, of course, these ladies would be called Miriam in Aramaic, was a very common name. It's like, you know, as Mary is today in the United States, or John is in our world. So it was very common to call your child, your daughter, Miriam, and evangelists not always give us the full background of these people. So to some extent, it's left to our imagination to see who they could be. But we're fairly certain that the two people who were at the crucifixion were Mary, the mother of Jesus, and certainly Mary Magdalene. Now, Mary Magdalene is a fascinating character, and I'll tell you why. Because who do the evangelists put at the empty tomb? Who is the person, the primary witness to the resurrection? It's Mary Magdalene. And that's amazing, because in ancient Judea, as we know from Jewish sources like the Mishnah, the testimony of a woman had no credibility in court. So if you had a lawsuit against someone, or if you were accused of something, and a woman spoke on your behalf, it had very little or no credibility in court. So why then is Mary Magdalene the person who witnesses the most quintessential event in Christianity? And I can only say it's because of God's design. It's the power of this character, this Mary Magdalene, who clearly was a pivotal person in Jesus' entourage. And that's one thing that I would like to highlight, because if there's one thing I try to do with this book, is emphasize that the people in the Bible are not just men. You know, there are many, many women who play a very important role in the Bible story. It's not just Mary Magdalene, but we have Esther, we have Dina, we have Hagar, we have Keturah. All of these young women play a crucial role in the bringing about of Israel, and that's certainly one thing we wanted to highlight
Well, we had an experience, I guess, gosh, has it been 10 years ago that the Da Vinci Code took us by storm and we developed these little cults of Mary Magdalene? I wonder, you had, knowing what happened as a part of, you know, this Da Vinci Code phenomena and the development in the United States of Magdalene cults. You know that she's going to be popular, but how do you deal with the reality of what we really know about Mary Magdalene? This is a mean question. It's sort of, how do you exploit that interest in Mary Magdalene and still be faithful to the what we sort of really know or what might be possible about her?
Yeah, it's a very good question, DG, because there is so much popular lore about Mary Magdalene, but she's such a fascinating character. You know, we have not only the Gospels, but we also have the so-called Gnostic Gospels. These are Christian texts that emerged among very faithful Christian communities in the late 1st and early 2nd century, the Gospel of Peter, the Gospel of Paul, the Gospel of Mary. And in these texts, the role of Mary Magdalene is even more pronounced. She is seen as an apostle in her own right. She is seen as a leader of a whole Christian movement, and that is extended into Europe. There is one tradition that says that she ultimately was buried in Vézelay. I was just at that church 2 months ago in the south of France, in Vézelay. Beautiful, beautiful church there. So whether there is historical fact supporting that, I don't know. I sort of question it, but how important is that? Is it not more important that the shining example of Mary Magdalene, of unquestioned faith and commitment to what Jesus was trying to do, isn't that far more important as a message, as a role model, really, than what the historical facts are? Whenever I travel, I come across that over and over again. Now, I'm a historian. I'm guided by facts, but I'm also a practicing Christian. And I don't think there's necessarily a conflict between the two. In fact, areas where historical evidence, archaeological evidence, forensic evidence overlap with the biblical narrative. That's what gets me all excited, and that's what we try to do with this book.
We are visiting about a brand new book published by National Geographic. It's called Who's Who in the Bible, Unforgettable People and Timeless Stories from Genesis to Revelation. And the author and leading, I can't just call you an author because this is a design miracle that you've got. You're the coordinator and author. Jean-Pierre Isbutz is our guest. You've introduced a topic that's really interesting to me, and you don't have to go there if you don't want to, but it is the intersection of science and religion. And I thought I heard you saying this, and correct me if I'm wrong, but I hear other scientists say that, and when they're confronted with stories in the Bible that maybe can't be proved or don't make sense are even more often conflicting versions of the same story coming out of the Bible. An answer is, well, this may not be factually in accordance with the facts as we know them, but it is a truth. But it represents a truth which I can accept. And right. Scientists, academicians who are people of faith, I hear this all the time. And is that what you're sort of saying, is maybe not all the facts in the Bible are right down the line that I could prove in court, but the truths are there for me?
Absolutely. That's what I would say. Because let's not forget the text that we're talking about, the Bible, these are stories and documents that go back as early as the early Bronze Age. You know, we're talking the second millennium BC. We're talking a span of 2,000 years, if not more. So, you know, the idea of history as an objective science, as objective analysis, is only a very recent phenomenon. It's only a 19th century invention, really, modern history making. For people in ancient times, in antiquity, the truth was that was communicated in a persuasive fashion. And that's why, for example, you see that story of Joseph in the book of Genesis uses literary material that was current in Egypt at the time. The story of Joseph and how he was almost seduced by the wife of Potiphar, Now, she doesn't have a name in the Bible, but in the Quran, she does have a name, Zulaikha. Is actually inspired by The Tale of Two Brothers, which was a bestseller, if you can call it that, in ancient Egypt.
Oh, well.
So what we see is that these stories that emerge among these proto-Israelites really use motifs, ideas from the surrounding culture to put forth the idea that there is a God and that the God takes a passionate interest in you, which is a very novel concept compared to the pagan mythology of Egypt or Greece or Rome, and that under the leadership of this God, the people will be led into a better life and a better future. And that is the overarching message. So I, you know, truth, what is truth? You know, as Pilate says in the Gospel of John, truth for me is cardinal virtues and cardinal ideas that are communicated in a way that the audience of its time understands. And yes, I mean, from 1300 B.C., that's about the marker that we as biblical archaeologists draw in the sand. From 1300 B.C., we begin to see things happening that resonate directly with the biblical narrative. And from that point on, we can put some historical frame around someone like King David or King Solomon, all the way into the prophets and beyond. Before that, it's a lot more difficult. But I'm not so concerned with the question of whether Abraham really lived or not. What's far more important to me is that Abraham is the very paradigm of a father of monotheism who would ultimately create the roadmap for three great religions.
Well, we're visiting with Jean-Pierre Isbot. He's the author of Who's Who in the Bible. He and I'll be right back. Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. My guest is Jean-Pierre Isbot. He is the author of Who's Who in the Bible. It's a National Geographic book. The subtitle is Unforgettable People and Timeless Stories from Genesis to Revelation and really and beyond. You've given me permission to call you Jean-Pierre, and I'll do that. You mentioned right before the break Pilate, and in the context of that famous question, what is truth? You tell us, you know, I tell you, one of the things that leapt out at me was that, how am I going to say this, that you, these are not your words, but that Pilate was sort of a second-rate person to have such a high job, that somebody from his class I think maybe the equestrian class or something like that he was sort of operating above his usual level, and that was stark. I had no sense of that from reading the Bible. Where did that? Am I right about that? And then, if so, where did it come from?
Well, it's a very good question, and we were just talking about the potential conflict or discrepancy between the historical record and the Bible, and this is one area where, as a historian, I must make a footnote that the character of Pilate is communicated in the Gospel of Mark as a sympathetic character, as someone who really takes an interest in Jesus and sees the evident innocence in the man and tries hard to save him from the wiles of the people outside who are clamoring for his crucifixion. There's a reason why Mark wrote that, because let's not forget Mark was in Rome writing for Romans at a time, we think, when Roman sons were fighting in Judea to suppress the Jewish rebellion. So it would be very difficult for Mark to make Pilate the villain of the story when he was trying to persuade his Roman audience of the fact that Jesus was the Messiah. And I understand that. And of course, that idea of the compassionate Pilate was then taken over by Matthew and Luke and John, who all based their passion story, we think, on the passion narrative of the Gospel of Mark. However, historically speaking, you're absolutely right. Pilate was a secondary person. He was not a senator. He was not of the senatorial class. He was a knight. Knights in the Roman society were certainly rung up from the general population, but they were well below the senatorial class, which was usually recruited for diplomatic positions abroad, such as a prefect or a governor. And we think the reason why he slipped through the cracks and was able to get himself appointed to that post is that Tiberius, at that time, had withdrawn from government and was basically living the good life on the island of Capri, and who could fault him for the island? Instead, the Roman government, from day to day, was ruled by the head of his Praetorian Guard called Sejanus. And there is a theory that Sejanus and Pilate were well known, were friends, and that Sejanus, while Tiberius was away, was able to get his friend appointed to a post in Judea, which was not, let's face it, a very attractive post. There was no wealth to be made. You know, and you went as a prefect or a governor, you went to these positions with one goal only, and that was to make a killing, to really get yourself very, very wealthy until you were sent back to Rome. And that's what these governors all tried to do. Well, there was no wealth to be had in Judea, which is why when we read Josephus, Pilate was caught with his hand in the till when just 3 years before the crucifixion, actually 2 years before the crucifixion, it was discovered that he was trying to siphon money out of the treasury of the temple in order to, quote unquote, build an aqueduct. Yeah, right. that led to very violent protests. So Pilate, in sum, was not a very nice character. And eventually, as Roman documents tell us, he was dismissed from his post 5 years after the crucifixion because of excessive cruelty to the people he was supposed to govern. Now, which is, that in itself is amazing because, you know, Rome didn't care if you were, you know, governing with kid gloves or not. What they were concerned about was, you know, can you keep law and order? Can you collect the tribute, the taxes on time? That was the only thing they were concerned about. And so for Pilate to be removed for excessive cruelty by the Roman Senate, based on an appeal from Samaritans, among others, is a clear indication that this was not a very nice person.
Well,
so we do have to keep that in mind.
Well, this raises another question that those of us who read the Bible often have, particularly in the New Testament times, and that is, it looks like there are a lot of people in charge. Is Pilate in charge, or is there this guy or guys named Herod in charge? And you unscramble that a little bit in Who's Who, but tell us a little bit about how it worked that you've got a king, sort of a local king in one sense, and then you've got the representative of the Roman government maybe in overall total charge. How did they sort out that power structure?
Well, you're actually right. It was a mess. It was a mess. And the reason why it was a mess is because when Herod the Great died in 4 BC, in his will, he divided up his territory, this great kingdom of Herod the Great, amongst some of his sons. Many of his sons he had assassinated. It was a mess, which is why we have a timeline of the Herod family, because otherwise you just get too confused. But to make a long story short, by the time that Jesus was conducting his ministry, there were basically three principal regions in that former kingdom of Herod the Great. And the area of Galilee was run by Herod's son named Antipas. Now, to confuse the story, he is also referred to as Herod Antipas, which is why in the Gospels you come across the name of Herod very often, but sometimes it refers to Herod the Great, and sometimes it refers to his son, Herod Antipas, who was not a king. He was what we call a tetrarch, which is sort of a demoted king of a much smaller area. And he was not a very nice character either. But he was in charge of Galilee, whereas Judea, and this was the main difference, Judea had been originally allocated to another son of Herod, Archelaus, but he made such a dog's breakfast of his government that Augustus said, we're done. And he was sent into exile, and at that point, in 6 AD, Judea became a Roman province, which is why we have the story of the crucifixion, which is why we have a Roman prefect sitting in trial over Jesus, because he, at that point, was the Roman ruler of the province, the Roman province of Judea, whereas Herod was up north ruling in Galilee. Now, Matthew, very briefly, Matthew brings in the story that Pilate consulted, Caiaphas consulted Herod, who was in Jerusalem, in town for the Passover feast. That's very, very possible. But more than likely, the decision to crucify Jesus came directly from the Roman prefect, because only the Roman prefect, only the Roman government, was entitled to put a man to death at the time.
We're visiting with Jean-Pierre Isbot about his book, Who's Who in the Bible. It's a National Geographic book. He and I'll be right back. Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. My guest is Jean-Pierre Isbot. He is the author of Who's Who in the Bible. It's a National Geographic book. And you're telling us all these fascinating stories about the biblical characters. I've been reading Acts and Romans, and so I'm interested in your views about St. Paul, and I want to thank you for the wonderful map that you've got trying to show the various routes that St. Paul took on his mission trips. And before that, I want you to talk about Pharisees. And we learn in your book and also in the Bible that Paul or Saul had been a Pharisee. And that's in the context of this running conversation between Jesus and the Pharisees in the Gospels. And as I read it this last time, I didn't think as badly of the Pharisees as I had before. And it seemed to me that they were asking Jesus pretty good questions. I mean, it got to be a contest. But I wondered if they were really during the time of Jesus' ministry, really as antagonistic against Jesus' thoughts, and whether Jesus felt as estranged from the Pharisees as we've been brought up to think. Am I off on a wrong wild goose chase?
No, not at all. In fact, that's an excellent question, Eugene. One thing that I tried to do in my previous book, and some of it bleeds also into this book, Who's Who in the Bible, but in my previous book, In the Footsteps of Jesus, I make a concerted effort to exonerate the Pharisees. This is what happened. You know, the Pharisees were a group of fairly educated people. You could mostly find them in the city, so it was an urban community. And these were deeply pious people. And they were fiercely opposed to the other group, the Sadducees, who were in charge of the sacrifice at the temple, because they felt like, you know, life is not about sacrifice. You can just do awful things and then go and slaughter a lamb or a bird and sacrifice it at the temple, and then everything will be okay. They were the first to articulate a whole new vision of Judaism that says it's all about purity, not purity of soul, but also purity in whatever we do in our everyday life. And in a sense, what they're trying to do is transfer the purity that was the purity cult that was practiced inside the temple to everyday life. And yes, they get a little obsessive sometimes about cleaning vessels and what is pure and what is not pure. And they were concerned about Sabbath observance. You know, on the Sabbath, if I'm hungry and I walk through a field, can I take the stalks of corn? Can I take that and pull it off and eat it or not? And these were questions that were hotly debated amongst each other. And some of these debates were quite passionate. And we know that because these debates were actually recorded and ultimately collected in a book called the Mishnah, which is something I've used extensively in my books. And of course, the Mishnah would then produce the wonderful tradition of the Talmud. But what I'm trying to say is that the idea of talking to rabbis amongst each other, sometimes passionately, about issues of Sabbath observance, about issues of cultic purity, were important things. And the fact that the Pharisees approached Jesus about these issues. It's not an attempt to entrap him. It's actually a mark of great respect, because they wouldn't necessarily bother with anyone unless they felt that this person had some interesting things to say. So I see these Pharisaic debates in the Gospels as actually a sense of how esteemed Jesus was as rabbi, as teacher. And he was called that. He was called rabbi. And the fact that they bring him into these debates is a mark of respect rather than a mark of antagonism. And where is the proof? The proof is the fact that when, in the Gospel of Mark, there's rumors that Herod Antipas is out to get Jesus, is out to arrest Jesus, as he previously arrested John the Baptist, so that threat was real. Who are the people who come to Jesus and warn him? They are the Pharisees.
Well,
it's the Pharisees who warn Jesus. So this is a little known footnote somewhere, but that really signals to me that there was a great consonance between the Pharisees and Jesus at the time.
Well, there's so many things I'd like to talk or have you talk to me about in your book, but your book raises the question of how your research and all of this work has impacted your own spiritual life. I noticed that at the end you give a lot of credit to your own pastor, and you mentioned earlier that you are you're not so much a skeptical scientist as you are a faithful member of your church. So how does your religious views and experience intersect with the challenges that arise as you do your work, both in terms of publishing books about the Bible, but the research that goes behind it? How does all that come together?
You see, if I had a penny for every time that question is answered, whenever we publish these books, I get a whole slew of emails.
Well, I say this with great respect, and if you want to not want to answer it, it's fine. I would understand.
No. I want to say, because obviously it's a great question, because it's obviously something that readers are very preoccupied with. You know, these are great history books, but to what extent does faith inform that? And I hope that books convey that there is a lot of faith. I'm a historian, so when it comes to looking at historical evidence, I will be rigidly guided by whatever is historically responsible. I will never claim anything that I don't think has scientific basis. But I don't see that in contrast to what the faith tradition tells us. So when people ask me in these emails, is there a difference between Jesus, the rabbi, and the Christ of faith? I said, of course there are discrepancies. We're talking on the one hand between a person that we can reconstruct by historical means, and on the other hand, a person that we know of through documents of faith. And of course there are some differences, but is that important? To me, it is absolutely not. And one thing that I mentioned in a presentation I gave at the Trinity Lutheran Church in Santa Barbara last Sunday, I said there are so many disagreements amongst us as Lutherans or Catholics or Methodists or even Orthodox when it comes to the interpretation of Scripture. But there is one thing that we can virtually all agree on, and that is the historical world of Jesus, the fundamental historical basis of the life of Jesus. So isn't that a wonderful basis for us to get together, discover our shared roots, and really come together in an ecumenical fashion, removed from the detail of doctrine? And I think that's what gets me going. It is certainly, faith is an important part, it's the most important part of my life when I write about these topics. But I find that history can support that faith, that can bring these people to life more than anything else, and as a result, deepen our belief in what the Bible has to say.
Well, I want to thank you personally for your time visiting with us about your new book, Who's Who in the Bible, Unforgettable People and Timeless Stories from Genesis to Revelation. And thank you for that time, and also for this wonderful book that will be an exciting complement to my life, and I'm sure to the others who are fortunate enough to acquire a copy. Thank you so much, Professor Isbood.
Thank you so much for having us. It's been a pleasure.
And thanks to you for listening. This is D.G. Martin, who's talking. I'll be back here before you know it.